Discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. You should always consult with an investment professional before making important investment decisions. Securities offered through J.W. Cole Financial, Inc., member FINRA, and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI, an SEC-registered investment advisor. 674 South College Avenue, Bloomington, Indiana. Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Big Show, Your Money with David Hayes. Thanks for hanging out with us. We are talking investments today. So Eric Geisler, the bond guru from CFCI, will be joining me in about 5 minutes. And later on, Mr. Rod Holloway, the portfolio guy over at our office, CFCI, he'll be joining us as well. We have a good show today. Kind of get you up to speed on what's happening after what was the worst third quarter in a really long time. So what do we expect going forward, and what should you expect when you open up those 401k statements or your investment statements here in just about another week or so? But before we get to all that, let's do a little news of the week brought to you this week by Bloomington Affordable Self-Storage. Reclaim the cluttered areas of your home with help from Bloomington Affordable Self-Storage over on 17th Street. It's newly remodeled with a 24-hour on-site management team offering pickup and truck rental. Call about their fall special at 812-339-4221. I talked to those folks today and I said, hey, I hope you get a lot of business from this because, you know, it is a place I'm going to store my own stuff for the winter. And they said they've gotten a couple calls. They've rented a few facilities. So I guaranteed them that I would at least drum up two or three more customers during this week's show. So do me a favor if you want to get rid of your junk for the winter. Give Affordable Self-Storage a call, and they'll help you out. All right, here we go, folks. The S&P and NASDAQ closed slightly higher on Thursday in a choppy start to the fourth quarter as investors waited for the monthly U.S. jobs report and the start of the earnings season. Still, the big question is, as investors look at the market and what they think they should do, when will the Fed start raising rates? Well, according to a Bloomberg study, 84% of economists polled on September 25th through the 28th expected an initial interest rate increase in December. But remember, folks, the last time we went through this, about 80% of them also thought September, and then they changed their tune. In a TD Ameritrade study, they found that 22% of Americans are giving financial support to an aging parent or adult child, and sometimes to both. On average, the cost is about $1,000 per month. Other highlights of the survey, 83% say they would support an aging parent over an adult child. Well, they should. They should do that. I can tell you it's going to be an epidemic for sure. Hey, you know how we talk about the stock market and all the time and how huge it is? Well, the stock market was worth about $25 trillion as of June 30th, 2015, and about 78% of that was capitalized by the S&P 500. But bigger than huge is the U.S. bond market. That includes things like treasuries, municipals, corporate, mortgage, and asset backs. It was worth almost $40 trillion. So did you know that? The bond market was bigger than even the huge stock market. The bond market was only worth about $11 trillion back in 1995, according to Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association. And finally, did you see this? Powerball ticket worth $310.5 million sold up in Michigan. Jim Harbaugh probably won that. The Michigan ticket holder won a grand prize of worth $310 million, according to Powerball website. The unidentified ticket holder picked all six winning numbers in the latest multi-state drawing on Wednesday, the lottery said. The winning ticket was sold at a gas station in southern Michigan, and it was said to be a really big Powerball compared to others, but there was one larger jackpot back in 2012 worth $337 million. Get advice, folks. I actually, back in the early 90s, met with a lottery winner as an advisor, and it's pretty interesting. The dynamics there of someone who comes upon a windfall, and depending on what their lifestyle was like before and their mentality and their family and their friends, it can be a pretty interesting thing. So get advice if you come upon a winning lottery ticket like that, and get it from someone that knows how to deal with people with millions and millions of dollars. We're going to take a break, folks. When we come back, we'll be joined by Eric Geisler, the bond guru of CFCI. We're going to be talking about the Fed, interest rates, the economy, and more. This is Your Money with David Hayes. You know, I listen to these commercials during the break, and I hear my good friend Steve Birch, who's opening up the Furniture Exchange, the old Suburban Bowling Alley. You're going to have to check this place out. It is unbelievable. And it really is going to be an outstanding selection of new and used furniture over there. So they're going to open up in October. I know he's been anxious to get it going, and I can't wait for him. It's going to be great. And then I heard Juan Carlos's commercial, and I thought, I've known Juan Carlos for years. I've never known how to pronounce his last name. So thank you, John Sean Hannity, for that. Joining me now on the phone is a guy I do know how to pronounce his last name, Mr. Eric Geisler. And Eric joins me now on the phone. Of course, he is the fixed income guru over at our office, CFCI. Hey, Eric, how you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me on, Dave.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time. As always, I know you're busy on Thursday nights. And let's get right into it. You know, of course, we go back and we remember that the Fed did not raise interest rates back in September. And then Janet Yellen came out last Wednesday and said, you know, I'm pretty committed to this, personally committed to this strategy, raising rates sometime this year. 89% of economists polled by some recent surveys suggest that that will happen at some point this year. My question to you, Eric, is we've been talking about this for a really long time. What is the market telling us, more importantly, than what Janet Yellen's telling us?
Well, not to be an alarmist, but I think that the bond market continues to kind of give a signal of trouble in the world economy. I think that the market is worried about the risks that are associated with Yellen either tightening or not tightening. It's worried about deflation, not so much in this country, but certainly in other parts of the world. Risk has become a big part, and we'll talk a little bit about that, I think, later. But all of those things, I think, has the market kind of, the bond market, certainly worrisome. And I think by the evidence of low interest rates, it's kind of signaling that there's not a whole lot of growth in the world economy today.
So let's go back to what the Fed actually controls, and I want to ask you another question about that. So the overnight borrowing rate between banks is what the Fed would trigger a rise on. But then you look at the capital markets and you look at the bond rates. The 10-year Treasury is close to 2%. It's actually come down in the last several weeks. So when the Fed raises rates, Eric, does that mean that we will see rates at the 10-year, the 20-year, the 30-year go up, or is that completely driven by global growth, global demand for U.S. Treasuries, and all of the economic factors that you were mentioning?
Well, the answer is no, we would not necessarily see an increase in rates in the 10-year or the 30-year Treasury rates, or even in mortgages. Probably what it signals is that the Fed is comfortable with the economy and that it's growing and it doesn't need easy money anymore, but the bond market is going to go where they think that in terms of level of yield and interest rate, it's going to go wherever it thinks that risk and inflation are really moving.
I have a piece from AXA, a large insurance company, and it talks about interest rates on the 10-year. And they say since 1963, rates have been above 4% on the 10-year almost 90% of the time. And we've been sitting here under 4% for quite some time. In fact, they according to their numbers, 1963 was the last time that actually hit 4%. But since then, if you look at what years it has been under, we're really talking 2008, 2009, 10, 11, 12. In fact, in 2012, it got down to 1.81%. 2014, here we are in 2015, still at 2%. So when you look at the norm, heck, when you go back to the 80s, and I don't hope we never get to this point because that's bad too, but in 1982, Eric, the 10-year Treasury was at 13.01%. Lord, help me if we ever get to that again. But the normal interest rates for a 10-year Treasury seem to be more in that 4% range. Are we going to see that in my lifetime or yours?
Actually, that's a great question, because I remember when you could buy tax-exempt municipal bonds that were highly rated, and we all sat around and we said, well, if we could only invest all of our money in those, we could sit around and clip a coupon for 30 years at 6 or 7%. And I don't think so, at least not in the near term, because we have become a global economy, and we've become so interconnected, and the risks are being shared by by all of the economies. I don't think so. I just don't see a reason for that growth or those inflationary pressures to creep into the market.
So you're always preaching.
As you know, a large part of that is demographics.
Oh, sure, right? It is. And you have always preached to us advisors to be cautious when using assumptions on interest rates when you're projecting out a retirement income plan for someone. This just tells me that folks are going to probably need more money than they first thought if they were assuming bigger returns in the equity markets and bigger interest rates on bonds. Because, Eric, I see people every day, you know my calendar's packed, and folks will come in and say, well, you know, if I can just earn 5 or 6% safely, and, you know, I try not to laugh because that's impossible in this environment. But I think people do need to adjust their expectations, don't you think?
Well, I think one of the greatest illustrations that was told to me is how many times have you seen a life policies illustration come true?
Yeah, right.
And it's negligible. Now, sometimes it's been better, but more often it's actually worse. I think you're exactly right on the head. None of us are very good about predicting the future, including the Fed. The Fed does not have a history through all of its chairmen of being right. It's certainly not in a timely fashion. So it's very difficult to predict the future. So, you know, nobody wants to be conservative, but everybody wants their money to be managed conservatively.
That's right. Well, let's talk about fixed income. Most people would own fixed income for a couple of different reasons, and I'm going to get into that in the next segment somewhat, but for income or preservation of capital, diversification. So the idea would be that when stocks are acting one way, bonds should be acting another way. But what we've seen lately is that even though interest rates have come down, we haven't necessarily seen the price appreciation in the fixed income. So my question to you, Eric, is what are the other factors that cause bond prices to change other than just interest rates?
Well, I think the biggest one is credit risk. And I think that right now, or certainly most of this year, you have seen the premium that is paid for credit risk in the bond market has increased, which is kind of understandable because as bond prices have come down, that's somewhat reflective of maybe the anticipation of lower earnings. And so if companies are having trouble with revenues or sales, that's also an additional credit risk or a risk that's being transferred over on their debt side, right? Can they pay their bills? And so I'm not surprised that we're seeing the credit spreads or the premium that is charged for taking that credit risk also being reflected in the stock market.
I had someone ask me this week, man, shouldn't I buy a bunch of these energy stocks that are down so much? And my answer was, if you have the tolerance for risk, maybe, but if you're looking for just a good total return, I would maybe look at the debt side of this rather than the equity side. Every industry, and we just talked about it before we came on with you, Eric, that the bond market is much bigger than the equity market. And when you look at the availability of debt in that energy sector, you can pick up some pretty good deals potentially that maybe mature in 2, 3, 4 years at yields that we've never seen before on some pretty high quality debt.
Well, and quality is the key word right there. There is quality, and there are going to be survivors out of the decreased stock prices and the lower capitalization of these companies. But there are some that are bigger. There are some that have an easier time of selling assets to raise cash, and therefore that quality of those companies may or are a good value in this market. The problem is being able to sort through those and being able to identify. Too often, I think, in our business, we're kind of pushed to buy or sell something based on kind of the flavor of the day.
Eric Giesser has been our guest for this segment, the man who likes to make the most with the least amount of risk, without a doubt. So, Eric, we appreciate you keeping us out of trouble and keeping our expectations in check. We appreciate that very much.
Well, thanks for having me on, Dave. I appreciate that as well.
Thanks, E.
Have a good one.
Thanks, guys. When we come back, four questions you should be asking about your income investments. When we come back, this is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. It is the Investment Show. Thank you again to Eric Geisler for calling in. Rod Holloway will be joining us in about 5 minutes or so to talk about the equity markets. But, you know, as you talk about fixed income, I think there's four questions that you need to ask about your investments. You know, the market presents investors with a lot of challenges, the reliability of income, as well as interest rate and credit risk, as Eric mentioned, and that should always be considered when evaluating your income-producing investments. When it comes to reliable income, investors should know the differences between income from stocks and income from bonds. Big difference between the two. Interest payments on bonds are an obligation of the issuer and can generally only be disrupted if the issuer defaults. Dividends on stocks, on the other hand, are paid only when the board of directors declares a dividend and decides to pay one. And that's on a quarterly basis. So when you buy a bond, it has a fixed interest rate generally for a fixed period of time and a fixed maturity date. So I think it's important to understand the different types of risk that you're comfortable with and the trade-offs associated with each strategy. So be sure to address at least these four questions. Number one, what do I own and why? What role do income-producing investments play in my overall portfolio? Now, individual bonds, as Eric was talking about, have long been the traditional option for fixed income. So it's important to understand why you own them. One would be for predictable income, diversification from equities, two, preservation of capital would be three, and then total return opportunities, like we were talking on the energy bonds a few minutes ago. Number two, what will happen to my portfolio, my income-producing portfolio, when interest rates rise? When interest rates rise, bond prices typically go down, and holdings with higher duration, which is a measurement of interest rate sensitivity, that generally is associated with longer maturities as well, they're going to experience higher price swings in response to rate moves. Now, duration shouldn't be avoided altogether because there's generally a trade-off. Those bonds with higher duration will typically pay you more income versus those that are at shorter maturity. So if you own individual bonds to receive steady, consistent income, you might not be as concerned about changes in the value of your bonds since they will continue to pay periodic interest and return the face value at a specified date, of course, bearing issuer default. Now, that's important to understand. But what other risk are you exposed to when it comes to your fixed income investments? It's important to understand that there's trade-offs. There always is. Shorter maturity bonds of similar qualities will typically have lower price volatility and a lower yield. Higher yielding bonds produce more income, but they also have higher credit risk, like Eric was saying. Right now, quality is key. Now, we wouldn't tell you to avoid something with a little less quality, but we would think a little shorter maturity might make more sense. The other thing is non-U.S. dollar denominated bonds. They can provide some diversification, attractive yields, but they carry currency, credit, and geopolitical risk. Remember the Brazilian bonds a few years ago? If you're in the investment world and you buy bonds, I can tell you they were being pushed hard a few years ago. Sure glad we don't own them now. And then number four, what actions should I take to mitigate some risk and achieve my goals when it comes to my fixed income investing? Well, first of all, start by confirming again, why do you own fixed income investments? What role are they going to play in your overall asset allocation? And evaluate your risk tolerance and view of the risk that may be present going forward. Credit risk, interest rate risk, you know, all that. So if you have an advisor, and of course I'm a big pro advisor, I am an advisor, we can run analysis on individual bonds that you own and assess their credit quality. We can also use the analysis to quantify the potential impact of rising interest rates. We have a really cool tool that Eric can use that just basically lays it all out. If you have a half a point change in the 10-year or 1 point change in the 10-year, what does this do to the value of my portfolio? But do not confuse, and this is important, do not confuse individual bonds with package products like bond funds, because individual bonds provide that finite maturity date, while bonds in a package product only offer a shared interest rate of pooled bonds. They're with outside managed control. It may be impacted by fund flows, people buying and selling the fund, changes in the fund management, or other factors that are out there. So individual bonds, like they don't have a maturity date. So individual bonds allow an investor to really control ownership or action. And I've had to preach that. In fact, I'm going to be making a bunch of phone calls over the next couple of days because statements won't be looking that hot over the next week or two when they get them. And a lot of it is in the bond prices. Like Eric mentioned, the credit spreads have widened. So a good quality bond that's paying a good quality interest rate that's going to mature in just a handful of years looks like it's worth a lot less than it was last month. But I'm making the calls to say, remember, this is why we own them. Focus on the face amount. Focus on the interest rate. And we'll get people off the ledge if they're a little bit concerned. So again, know what you own. Manage the duration of your portfolio. Improve the credit quality of your investments right now. We think that's important. Diversify across all types of income-producing investments, not just corporates or munis, or BDCs, across the spectrum of income-producing investments. And like I mentioned with Eric, he likes to earn the most with the least amount of risk. He's the most conservative guy that I've ever met. Almost drives me crazy conservative, but it keeps you out of trouble. And then structure your bond portfolio to allow for a disciplined investment strategy that you're not trying to change all the time. Does that make sense? I hope it does. We're going to take a break, folks. When we come back, we'll be joined by Rod Holloway. He is the equity portfolio manager at CFCI. I'm going to be talking to him about the 7-year cycle. It's getting a lot of news where every 7 years something tends to happen in the market. Well, guess what? We're 7 years removed from a biggie. When we come back, Rod Holloway with CFCI. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Just about every single day, Rod Holloway, Hot Rod, comes walking into my office with a publication or two and hands us to it me and will say, hey, this is a really good explanation of this or that, maybe some good radio show material. Earlier this week, he brought in an article from Guggenheim and a guy that we followed for many, many years, Scott Meinard. He's the chief investment officer for Guggenheim. And he wrote an article that talked about a painful but healthy adjustment for risk assets. Joining me now on the telephone is Rod Holloway, the portfolio manager of CFCI. And I have to say it that way, Rod, because the Ohio State University is coming in to play the Hoosiers on Saturday. So there you go, Hot Rod. Take it away. It is a healthy adjustment for risk assets, in our opinion, isn't it?
Yeah, most definitely. We had talked about, back at the beginning of the year, there was a lot of discussion about, is the market overvalued? Is it fairly valued? And we felt as though, well, it's probably fairly valued. You were sitting somewhere around a 17 price-to-earnings multiple on the S&P 500. That crept up in the early part of the year, and you approached 18. So 18's not unreasonable or way overvalued, but here's the problem. We no longer have the same earnings growth that was projected at the beginning of this year heading into next year. Now, that doesn't mean that it's extremely bad. It just means things need reset. There are headwinds globally that are going to cause companies to not have as much earnings growth as what we originally had anticipated. So back at the beginning of the year, the problems were Greece, were Puerto Rico, mm-hmm. were the sovereign debt issues. Well, those weren't going to have an impact on earnings. Those were more concerns about sovereign debt, and if they default, what kind of ripple effects would fall through the bond market globally. Now we're actually talking about economic slowdown in China, the fact that Europe still hadn't really taken off, even though they've begun some of their stimulus programs, and then even emerging markets, there are many of them that are actually in recession already, and others that are teetering on it. So, yeah, we have to have a reset on earnings, and that's kind of what you're getting here when you've had this sell-off that we had in August. You come back down. Now, all of a sudden, earnings multiples start to shrink and get down, and then there is still growth projected for next year. It's just not the same growth that we had originally anticipated. So we do need a bit of a reset. And as you said, in the headline, it talks about painful. It is really hard to buy at the time that you really should be buying because you kind of feel sick. You get your statements. You've gone down quite a bit. August was a bad month. September followed it up with another bad month. This third quarter is one of the worst quarters we've had in quite some time. So people aren't extremely excited and feel great about the prospects of the stock market because of the recent statements that they're going to get in the mail. But that's typically the best time to be accumulating a nice shopping list and go out and start slowly wading into stocks with the cash that you may have on the sidelines.
Rod Holloway joins us live on the radio here. And Rod, you and I spent hours today back in the war room going through individual accounts, looking at allocations, looking at returns, comparing those to indices, looking at income. And that's really what you need to do in a time like this. And And you and I talked about some reallocations of some cash, taking advantage of this market. But what you did say to me is, you know, even though this market sell-off reflects a long-awaited sell-off, something we've said the market's needed for quite some time, U.S. fundamentals, they're supportive of continued growth, like you said, but technical indicators are still pointing to lower prices in these risk-on assets, aren't they?
Yeah, most definitely. And right now, what a lot of people are starting to do is they're reflecting back on 2011. In 2011, we had similar patterns in which you had a steep sell-off in August. You had a real quick bounce back, but then you sold off again, went back down, retested those lows, actually traded sideways for a little while. You actually had an intraday low that came in lower than that August low. You finally started to work your way back up as the year progressed, but you really didn't get back to the highs of 2011 until early 2012. So it was about a 3 to 4 month process that happened. Now, using 2011 and that discussion doesn't mean things are going to happen exactly like it did then, but it is a good gauge to look at, because really when you look at it, you wonder what was going on economically, what caused some of that. Well, there were issues. Most of them were domestic issues. That was when the S&P downgraded the United States debt. That's when the government was flirting with not passing a bill that was going to cause us to default on some of our debt. So it was predominantly domestic issues. Now, of course, today, the issues aren't predominantly domestic. They are pretty much global, but you still have other issues. And that's why we say it's not necessarily a repeat of 2011, but it is very interesting when you lay the pattern of S&P 500 from 11 over where we're at today. They look eerily similar right now. But, yeah, technically, we're not getting ready to bounce. So, like, when you saw a strong day on Wednesday of this week, that was no reason to feel as though you had to rush in with your cash, because this is probably going to be a process that will develop over time, and especially given that August, September, and October are historically some of the worst months out of the calendar year for the market.
Rod, we have this piece from AXA that talks about the 7-year cycle from a historical perspective, and it talks about how the market cycles allows us to have an idea of what may happen in the future with, like you were mentioning, some of the past charts and indicators that we've had. So whether to go short or long term, it doesn't really matter. But there's this thing that it's getting a lot of press. I mean, it's getting a lot of press on the internet. A lot of people are talking about it, called the 7-year cycle. And I'm going to go through this briefly. Back in 1987, we had Black Monday. 1994, we had the Russian bond default. Some people call it the bond crash. 7 years later, 2001, technology bubble burst. 7 years later, credit crisis, 2008. 7 years later, Rod, 2015, and it says question mark, question mark, question mark. I guess when you think about these types of things, the 7-year cycles, put that in perspective for us so that people can maybe put their nerves at ease if this is something that they're really hanging their hat on.
Sure. Well, number one, it becomes very difficult to do your investment plan mapped around these calendar events that people talk about. So whether it's this 7-year cycle, whether it's sell in May and go away or any of those things, that is not always easy to adjust your investments accordingly. And of course, it doesn't always happen, even though it may consistently happen. The other thing that I'll say is, you know what? It's pretty easy to make statistics say what you want them to say based on the story that you're telling. So what I would argue against in that 7-year cycle to point out, yes, there was a massive crash in 1987 of October, but overall, if you look around that time period, pretty decent market outside of that major crash that happened in October of 87. The tech bubble bursting. I personally believe tech bubble bursted in around the second to third quarter of 2000, not 2001. But once again, if you want to run the 7-year cycle, you don't say the tech bubble burst in 2000. You say it happened in 2001 because the 7-year cycle didn't work, because it was actually only 6 years on that bubble bursting in that one. So you have to be cautious when people use different statistics, because it's easy to make them tell the story you want it to, but it may not be the best way to invest your investments and map out your allocation for the future.
Yeah, and if you would have stayed invested in 1987, post the Black Monday, Rod, by the end of the year, it didn't turn out quite as bad as what maybe that 7-year cycle chart would make you believe. So you got to keep your head on a swivel, as they say. Rod, we appreciate you taking the time, as always. And I guess I need to ask you one quick question, Rod. Do you need to store any stuff? Does Kelly want you to get stuff out of the house? Because I did talk to the folks at Affordable Storage and told them that I was going to drum up at least 2 new customers, and I can't count myself. For affordable self-storage. So they run a fall special, Hot Rod.
Yeah, well, right now the basement is accumulating a lot of stuff, but as I am finishing that out, it's getting smaller and smaller storage areas, so they could have a new customer in the future when I get that basement done.
All right, Rod, make sure you tell them that I sent you so they can mark that one off my list. Hey, Rod, thanks a lot. I'll see you in the morning.
All right, sounds good, Dave.
All right, guys, we'll take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about some questions of the week, and there were some good ones this week. We had a person, actually, and I should have kept Rod on for this one. They came in, and they were really up on one stock. They were really down on another stock, and I looked at that, and they were like, is there anything we should be doing about this? We came up with a pretty good plan for them to take advantage of the gains, to take advantage of the losses. When we come back, we'll talk about that. We also have couple questions regarding some asset protection questions. We also had one about money that they're needing for long-term care. All kinds of great questions. When we come back, this is Your Money with David Hayes. You know, someone, I won't be here for the Ohio State football game, Indiana versus Ohio State on Saturday. Going to be out of town. Fall break for the kids in Monroe County Schools happening next week. So we'll be on a short vacation, taking friends with us. It'll be a lot of fun, but won't be here. But I had an email from a friend of mine in Colorado that said, are you ready for the beatdown we're going to have on Saturday? I don't think it's going to go that way. I mean, I think Ohio State is good, obviously, number one in the country, you know, have tremendous weapons all over the place. They're insanely deep. But I think you'll be surprised when the Hoosiers come out. I think they'll put up a good fight. Now, they're going to wear us down more than likely and put up points at the end, but just that's what I think is going to happen on Saturday. So just keep your head up, guys, and do the best you can, and we just need 2 more wins to go to Detroit because I'm sure we'll be at the Motor City Bowl. I've been waiting for a long time to go to a bowl game, so please, please, please win at least 2 more in the Big Ten. I'll be up there, even though it'll be freezing. Motor City Bowl, that's my prediction. So we'll see how that all falls together. All right, guys, we had some questions of the week, but before we do that, I want to talk to you about someone that we had in this week. They actually had inherited some stock some time ago, and we were sitting down talking about what they had and what they should do with it. And they had one stock that had about $50,000 worth of gain, and she wanted to keep it. She had another stock that was down about $65,000. She also wanted to keep it, maybe. So what we did to try and take advantage of both of these situations, we sold the one with the gain, and we bought it right back. How can you do that? Because there are no wash sale rules on gains. So we took the $50,000 gain. Now we realize that. Then we sold the loser to offset it. $65,000 with a loss. She'll have another $15,000 of carry forward losses that she can use. She can not only just eat up that 50 grand, but she'll be able to use a $3,000 loss this year, $3,000 next, $3,000 next, through that, all the way through the 15 grand. Now, you can't buy back the same stock that you sold because that at a loss because that is a wash sale rule and you can't do it. But you can wait 31 days and buy it back. So what I told her, why don't we buy something similar in the same sector and just in case things go up, you don't want to miss out. I mean, because a rising tide does usually raise all ships. So we bought into a couple of different companies that were similar to what she already had. And I said, in 31 days, I'll call you back and see if you want the old company back or not. So again, she inherited the stock from her dad. She didn't really want to sell any of it, but we were able to reset the cost basis on the highly appreciated company, which was pretty cool. So just some ideas for you that if you're sitting out there in a similar situation, it's a good way to handle it. All right, folks, we had a question here from Leroy. I actually took this on the phone the other evening around 9 o'clock at night. So it was from a friend of mine who asked if I would talk to their cousin that lives in the state of Missouri. So I did. It was around 10 minutes till 9. I was completely zonked by the time I got off the phone with him. But he said he went to his attorney, and they said there was no way to protect what he has from the nursing home. But I'm sure that there is. He said he had a farm that was worth about $1 million, had about $1 million in retirement accounts, and he had another $300,000 in CD and some in checking and savings. So Leroy and I talked about this, and what we determined was that if you have the money to pay for the early part of care, you can always do some exemption planning later, because here's what he wanted to do. He thought, I'm ready to stick all this stuff in my kids' names, and that's the way to protect it. And this guy's like in his mid-60s, so he's not very old. And I was like, okay, well, here's the problem with that. When their name goes on this farm, or this, and they can't go on the retirement account, they can't on the CDs, it's theirs. And it's subject to all the things that could happen, liability risk, divorce, all this kind of stuff. Well, then you could stick it into a trust. Yeah, you could do that too, but they have to be the trustee. They're in control. And you're awfully young for that, Leroy. So that's the discussion that we had. So I said, I don't know that I'd do anything right now. What I would do is make sure that you had the money set aside to take care of yourself if you need to, and that could be for whatever reason, a home health care stay, assisted living, nurse, whatever. And then it gives you time to do some asset protection. The way the Medicaid laws work right now is, number one, you have to be broke to get Medicaid. But number two, there's a five-year look-back period. And we've had our friend Lance Lyke on the show, Tom Bunger, and they've all talked about this. You can transfer an asset to someone or something like a trust, and the five-year clock starts. So at the end of 5 years, you look back, and as long as you haven't given away anything for less than fair value, then you can go on Medicaid, blah, blah, blah. So I said to Leroy, don't do anything drastic right now. You have the money to be able to pay for your long-term care. If you have an inkling that this might happen, if you go into nursing home, then we'll start doing the exemption planning. Don't do it now. So that was some good advice, hopefully, for my man Leroy. And we came up with a couple of other good ideas as well, and I'll get to one of those later with a question from Keith. In fact, why don't we just go there right now? This gentleman named Keith, he said, I want to put my money into something that I can tap for long-term care expenses if needed down the road for both me and my wife. But all my money is in IRAs, and I hate the idea of pulling it out, paying the taxes, and putting in something just in case I need the money. So I feel like I'm stuck between a rock and a hard place. I'm sure you've dealt with this before. What do you think? Well, that is a big issue, folks. And if you think about the statistics on long-term care, the State Life Insurance Company, I have a piece from them, and they say over 70% of individuals over the age of 65 will require some type of long-term care services during their lifetime. What I found interesting is over 40% will need care in a nursing home for some period of time. Women will need it for a longer period than men. Women, 3.7 years on average. Men, 2.2 years. But what I found interesting is Alzheimer's, the average is 8 years. And that's where the epidemic is. People are getting dementia and Alzheimer's at an alarming pace. So that's what you need to prepare for. So we talked to him. I said, I found this a pretty neat product where you can transfer in a portion of your IRA into a long-term care type policy. And the Pension Protection Act back in, 2006, I think it was 2006, made this an option. But most carriers didn't have an option for you to use your IRA money to provide it for a long-term care policy. So the way it works is you move the money into an IRA, transfer, no taxes, and then it slowly drips into the policy for long-term care, and you're maintaining the value, the cash value that you had in your IRA, but it slowly moves from taxable to tax-free. If you choose for long-term care, it's tax-free. If you die, there's a death benefit. It also pays out tax-free. So it's a really cool way of simply taking money from your left pocket and sliding it into your right pocket over a period of time. So there are ways to do this, Keith, and he and I are actually going to work on that when I get back from fall break. Had a question here. Paul asked, first of all, hope you're doing well. Made some inquiries and found about $44,000 in funds that were in a retirement account that my sister had. She's now deceased, and she had it through her job. Since her husband was deceased at the time of her death, they had no kids, our parents are the next in line to get the money. Dad's health is very poor, and they've been looking for suggestions on how to use these funds that might be invested to provide more income in the case Dad passes and Mom's income is cut. What do you think? Well, you know, Doug Hughes says it best. It's always easier to get into things than out of things. So when you're put in a situation like this, I suggest that you don't do anything again. You put it in the bank, keep it liquid, kind of see how things play out with Dad. You know, really evaluate what kind of income you may lose. You know, like if it's Social Security, people don't think about this, but if you have, you know, two people getting Social Security and one person dies, yes, the highest available benefit is now the new benefit, but you still lose the other one. What about a pension? Most people don't select 100% pension survivor. They may pick a 50%. So your pension was 1,000, now it's 500. So yes, you need to be aware of this and exactly what incomes are going to be cut, and that may help you drive the decision on what you do with that money. But with, if dad's health is poor, you know, Eric mentioned it, we've mentioned it a lot, there's not a lot of places to put your money right now on a short-term basis to make much. So just leave it in the bank. That's usually the best option when you have a lot of uncertainty around. Here's another question from Doug. Let's see. I've been looking online for different investment options and keep coming across, keep coming across something called an indexed annuity. Sounds pretty good, but I know if it sounds too good, it probably is. What's your take on this? Well, first of all, you could go pick up our book, Today's Guide to Retirement Planning, a resource for those over age 50. We have a complete section on indexed annuities that you can read. It explains the basics to you and how it works, and we actually use the term in there. It's easier to get into things than out of things, but I'll briefly talk about it and encourage you to pick up our book. You can get it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Author House. It's about, I believe it's, you know what, I forgot how much it costs. I think it's $16 to pick it up. And that'll explain everything you need to know about it. But essentially the way it works is if the equity markets go up, you'll participate in the market. And it's not much. There's generally caps of 2 or 3 or 4%, or maybe it's a participation rate like 30, 40, or 50%. But you're not going to get all the market. In fact, you probably won't even get half the market. But if the equity markets go down, you simply lose nothing, zero. And we call it the power of zero. Because then the next year, if the markets go up, then you go up. So every time it goes up, you go up. Every time it goes down, you stay the same. Doug Hughes is a proponent of these, using them as an asset allocation piece. We don't ever suggest that you put too much money into any one thing, but these do typically have long surrender periods, meaning there's a surrender penalty if you take out more than, say, 10% per year after the first year. And they can be pretty stiff, 12, 13, 14%. That's how they work. So again, that's a brief explanation. We're not down on it for sure, but we want you to be up on it. And I think the best way to get up on it is to pick up our book, Today's Guide to Retirement Planning. Folks, that wraps up the questions of the week. We're going to take a break, come back, and wrap up the big show. This is Your Money with David Hayes. You know, I said years ago when they started moving towards this balanced schedule with the MCCSC and you have a full week off in the fall, a full week off in the spring, this is going to cost me more money. And that's exactly what's happening. We'll be on vacation next week. It is fall break around here. So we will replay last week's show with rock star Mary Beth Franklin, contributing editor of Investment News, talking about Social Security claiming strategies, Medicare, healthcare costs from retirement, all kinds of great things. Folks, if you see my book laying around in doctor's offices, don't steal them. We've been secretly placing them for your enjoyment, getting you to read the first chapter and then buying it online. And lastly, guys, go Hoosiers, beat the Buckeyes. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks, everyone. Goodbye. Discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Guest opinions on this show do not necessarily represent those of the radio station, David Hayes, or CFCI. You should always consult with an investment professional before making important investment decisions. Investment advice offered through CFCI, an SEC registered investment advisor, 674 South College Avenue, Bloomington, Indiana.